If anyone's in the wrong room, this is Review of Gravitational Physics. I'm Ruth Gregory, and you have the dream team teaching this course, which is myself and David at the back. And I'm in office 267, which is like kitty corner from David's office. And my conventions are going to be the opposite signature, probably, to the one that David used, I'm guessing. So I have time-like distances being positive, plus, minus, minus, minus. And those are my conventions for Riemann and Ricci. And I put H bar and C to one, but not G, usually. So, and that's simply because when we get to thinking about gravity in different numbers of dimensions, you've got to be careful. It's not consistent necessarily to set G equals one. There was someone in the wrong course there. Okay, so so this is quite a sort of formal or theoretical course. So I'm not going to be doing lots of practical or numerical stuff, but I gather there's going to be options for that later. We are going to cover, sort of in the first week, it's going to be more mathematical. So we're going to be reviewing some of the topics that you've already met in your first GR course, but expanding on some of them, maybe filling in, you know, some things that there wasn't time to cover on a first pass. So like the first week's going to be more about background, mathematical background. The second week is going to be mainly black holes. And the third week is going to be moving beyond. So we'll discuss more the cosmological constant and sort of, you know, aspects of gravity with lambda. We'll discuss quantum aspects of gravity, not quantum gravity, but some aspects of things like black hole thermodynamics and instantons. And then and probably a bit of beyond Einstein gravity. So we'll look at, say, Kaluza-Klein theory, and maybe discuss a little bit of low energy string gravity. So the first lecture is really going to be a review of differential geometry. So I know you've met a lot of these things before, but it's always useful to kind of start on the same page. And in particular, some of the notation may just be slightly different from what you've seen before. So when we try and think about Einstein gravity, we're kind of asking ourselves, what are we trying to describe? We're describing the world around us, that's the aim, but not necessarily the microscopic world around us. We want to think about things like the solar system, the universe, black holes, galaxies. That's the sort of context when we think about gravity. So one of the things that we have to be mindful of is that if we look at the world around us, say looking in this room, we kind of have already a strong concept of what things look like. So we have a concept of straight lines. We have our sort of trig rules, you know, angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. And we also have Euclidean geometry. So already we know that whatever we describe space-time with, we have to be able to transport these notions that we already have about the world around us. But we've also got a notion of curvature, even if not necessarily quite the same curvature as Einstein's, because we have the surface of the Earth. Now, we're not flat earthers. Okay, hopefully. we have this notion of traveling on the Earth. And, certainly speaking personally, and I know quite a lot of you in the audience as well, we'll have recently taken a long-haul flight to Toronto. And if you look at what the flight path is, it's rarely what looks like a straight line. So we do have a notion that you know, things can be curved. We do, you know, that maybe a straight line is not, or what looks like a straight line is not the shortest distance between two points. So what do we mean by that? And so really, these are the sort of things that Einstein gravity deals with, or more correctly, differential geometry. So we have to preserve this idea of our sort of local picture of the universe, as well as describing these notions of curvature. And so that's, if you like, a more flexible structure. So we're going to, I know you've met a lot of these concepts, but let's kind of do them again, because it never harms to refresh one's memory. You may find the second time round it's so much easier. So our description of the world around us in Einstein gravity is based on manifolds. So this is this part of differential geometry. So our manifold, which is really our space-time, is going to be built up from something that looks locally like this room, something locally flat. So our space-time is a set of events. So if it was just differential geometry, we'd just say a set of points. And then we want it to look locally like some sort of flat space. So that's our idea. Our manifold locally looks like flat space. So all the time in this first lecture that I talk about this differential geometric structure, I guess in the back of my mind, I'm usually thinking of the two-sphere. So that's kind of our test manifold. It's a nice, it's a curved surface, but it's simple. We can visualize it. It's a two-dimensional surface embedded in three-dimensional space, and it exhibits all of the features that we're going to talk about because, you know, it does look locally flat because, well, the world looks flat as long as we don't look too far, look up too far. So we have our picture of our manifold, which is some generic blob. And what it means to look locally like Rn is saying that we kind of have a little copy of Rn over here, and a point in the manifold and a neighborhood of the point map to a point in Rn and some neighborhood of that point in Rn. So this is what we might call a chart. It's a map from our manifold into Rn. And so here my sort of in the back of my mind, I'm thinking this is x, y, z, and t, for example. Cartesian coordinates on Minkowski space-time. So that's what I've got in the back of my mind. But the statement about what a manifold is generic. It doesn't sort of mean specifically space-time. And so this, this manifold is endowed with all of these little open sets. Which maybe we call UI, and they're called charts. That map you from the manifold into Rn. So in our language, we would say these give us coordinates. And so the idea, the sort of manifold we want, we want it to be differentiable. So we ask, so hopefully you'll get used to the abbreviations. So we are going to consider this construction such that the charts are infinitely differentiable on the overlap, and we call this a C-infinity manifold. So we want differentiability because we want to do physics on the manifold, and usually physics involves differential equations, more or less. So the collection of charts is called an atlas. So far, so good. If we keep our two-sphere, our surface of the Earth in mind, this you can see why this language is used. Because if you think of the Times or whatever the Canadian equivalent is, Atlas of the World, that is a set of flat pieces of paper in a book that you turn over. Well, probably not these days, but you've got the idea. And so each bit is representing a certain part of the Earth. It's all a nice flat piece of paper. And there's overlap, there's sort of overlap from one page to the next. And the overlap is really, you know, you can see, I mean, formally not necessarily infinitely differentiable, but you can match up from one page to the next. And the whole atlas covers the whole world. So that's kind of where all this came from. And it corresponds intuitively to what we understand by sort of representing our curved manifold, the surface of the Earth, by some sort of local set of flat maps, charts. So now what we want to do is to transport structure from R to the N into our manifold. So we want to use what we know about flat space to inform us about what happens in curved space. So we have to build things up one by one. And the first thing that we do is define functions on our manifolds. And we want them to be infinitely differentiable. So we take a function, which simply means that we associate a number with each point on the manifold. And then we just simply ask that it's infinitely differentiable on every chart. So in one of those little circles up there, I've got my values f of whatever the points are. I look over to where those points map in R to the N, so now I've got an f of x mu, and I'm asking that that f of x mu is infinitely differentiable. So that's all. So for example, in the universe, I might say cosmological time is a function, once I've chosen it. And so I have this notion there of surfaces of constant time in the universe. So that's a sort of visualization of a function. So that's structure one. The next thing we need is to just be careful about defining curves. So a curve, we know what a curve is, we just draw a sort of curvy line. What is it? It's a map from the reals into your manifold. And you want that the image of this curve in M is infinitely differentiable. So let me just say C infinity. So here we have our picture that we have the reals, we have our manifold. We're mapping some segment. into the manifold. That's our curve. That's what it looks like. But if we want to think about what we mean by infinitely differentiable, we then have to take a chart and consider the image of gamma in R to the n. So that's kind of how we're defining infinitely differentiable. So we might write x mu of t for gamma. So examples of curves are world lines of observers in relativity, or say a circle, just, you know, any sort of line. So now that we've got curves and functions, we can define vectors. So when we first meet vectors, we meet them either as a sort of something with a magnitude and direction, or as an ordered triple, because we usually meet them in R cubed. So the physical or physics of a vector is actually something with a magnitude and direction, because that's like a velocity or a force. Yet when we learn to manipulate vectors, we're often doing components. We're doing like ordered triples in R cubed. Now, the ordered triple doesn't really extend to this manifold. That doesn't really have, you know, some overall, in general, some overall labeling, rigid sort of Cartesian system. Whereas a notion of direction and magnitude is something that is not just representing the physics of a vector, but also actually the geometry. So here we define a vector as a linear operator which is tangent to a curve. So we have some sort of curve here, gamma. Here's our point P, and our vector we visualize as being a tangent to P. So what, when I say it's an operator, what do I mean? Well, it maps functions to functions. So it's a map from C infinity of M to C infinity of M, such that F goes to df by dt at P for all F in C infinity of M. So for every single function that acts on the manifold, you get a sort of f of t along gamma, if you like. So all of the functions have f of t along gamma. That f of t is now a real function. It's a map from R through the manifold onto the curve back to R by taking df dt. And that is true for any possible function that you could imagine. So if it was only true for one f, then that would not define a sort of independent operator. But it's the fact that this tangent vector is sort of associated with d by dt at p. So this definition does indeed satisfy the axioms of a vector space. So what we need to sort of show is sort of if we define a sort of gamma lambda of t to be gamma of t over lambda, then that takes our t into lambda t. So that tells us how we rescale vectors. And then notionally, if we want to add vectors, we simply take two curves, gamma 1 and gamma 2 of s, gamma 1 of t. So this would be our tangent vector t This would be our tangent vector S. And then at least locally to P, we can make a combination. Gamma 3 is like gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And we can define that sort of in a local chart, and so correspondingly we define S plus T as the tangent of gamma 3. So that tells us how to add. So this does define for us a vector space at P. So we call it TP of M, and then we can build up tangent spaces at every point. And then the collection of all the tangent spaces is the tangent bundle. So the picture here, if we think of our two sphere, is that we kind of lay a flat piece of paper on the North Pole so that it's tangent to the North Pole. So this is our squared, this is our flat tangent plane at the North Pole, for example. And then you would do take these flat tangent planes all around the sphere, and that would be the tangent bundle. So we then define cotangent or covectors as a map from a tangent space into the reals. So our vector kind of maps to some omega of V, or I'll probably often use this first week, this Fra and Ket notation, because it's sort of like the inner product. It's thinking of, you know, that's got that feel to it. And we say that omega is in the dual space. At P. So we can visualize this sort of via the dot product. That's one way of thinking about it. So the one thing about this so far, although we've got all these, or you know, pictures in the back of our minds, like the two sphere and like the tangent plane, which in essence have a notion of distance going, you know, in our minds, at the moment, nothing I've said requires any further structure on the manifold. So we're kind of building it up step by step, even though what we often used to visualize these concepts is sort of has a lot more structure. But here I'm not assuming that there's any sort of metric, at least not yet. So because we're talking about vector spaces, then that means that we can take a basis for our vector spaces. I didn't demonstrate that the cotangent space was indeed a vector space, but it's fairly clear how it satisfies the axioms. So since we have a vector space, we can take a basis on our vector space. And a common basis, and the one that probably you've used exclusively so far, is the coordinate basis. So what does that mean? Well, the coordinates are just the charts. So it's the labels that we assign to points in the manifold after we've mapped them onto R to the n. So if we think about the action of a vector on a function in C infinity of m, we're saying that that is df by dt at p. So if I then take, you know, at all times I'm thinking of this sort of picture of the manifold on the left and r to the n on the right, so I can write df by dt as dx mu by dt, df by dx mu. So I can take my, map everything across to r to the n, and then I can take the partial derivatives of f with respect to the local coordinates. And then each of the coordinates represent a line in the manifold, and so I can take d by dt of each of these coordinate functions. So I can regard each coordinate function, to x0, x1, x2, as just a member of C infinity of m locally, and therefore I can take the operator acting on that, d by dt, and then I can look at f in the local chart and take the partial derivatives of f. So this bit. So now I've written it that way, I can then take that expression and I can say that dx mu by dt I can write as t mu and then I have this package acting on my function. Now f was just some arbitrary element of that C infinity of m. And so this is what's representing my linear operator or my vector. So this whole thing is my vector. And so geometrically, that would be, in a book, it would be boldface T, so I'm underlining it. And so here, I'm kind of trying to distinguish between the T mu and the T. More, I'll say a bit more on that in a moment. So T is the geometric object or the vector. T mu are the components. Of the vector in the coordinate basis. And d by dx mu are like the basis vectors. So that is also a vector, d by dx mu. So similarly, for covectors, I can write omega as some set of components times dx mu. So this is the coordinate cotangent basis. So we're going to really deal with two main choices of basis for this week, one of which is the coordinate basis. That's kind of the familiar one. The other one we're going to look at is an orthonormal basis. But note, this requires a metric, so I'm kind of jumping ahead for a moment. But we write this as EA, and the idea is that once we have a metric, G of EA EB equals eta AB. So that means that if you take the contraction of two basis vectors that are the same with the metric, you get one, or minus one if it's space-like. If you take two different vectors and contract them with the metric, you get zero. So obviously this needs metric. But in general, so I might put a hat on these when I do it. So a general basis is going to be some combination of the coordinate basis elements. And so this is another notation you might see. So here, quite often, this might be called the Feuerbein or Feuerbein. And it's like, I think that comes from this notion of when you are thinking of a basis vector at every point, you might be sort of thinking in R cubed of sort of something that looks like your, you know, first three fingers. That would be a Dreibein. And so at every point, you're sort of imagining you've got this little sort of structure, and so it kind of looks like legs. So that's where it came from, this, because the Germans were developing all this rather than English or French. So this is sort of what a general basis might look like. Now, I'm making a bit of a meal of this because one of the things that sort of distinguishes whether you're doing this geometry from a mathematician's perspective or a physicist's perspective is often the notation that you use. And notation is a bit like language. So if you go into a sort of pure math seminar on geometry, you can often feel like you've gone to another universe or something, because the language that's being used is quite different, and also, you know, the perspective is different. So we want to be able to use our geometry, so we don't want to go too far to the dark side, but we do need to be able to use some of the tools. So I'm kind of going to try and skate a sort of fairly, you know, on fairly thin ice at times. But I do want to be able to use this geometric language, because we're going to look at a formalism for computing curvature, which is particularly efficient. And so for this week, I'm going to be using largely a geometric notation. So this was made clear by Roger Penrose when he sort of tagged what physicists do as abstract index notation. So let me try and get across what we tend to do in practice when we're working in GR, and why that's strictly not what mathematicians would do when they're doing geometry. And so what you're going to have to be careful about when I go through derivations about connections, curvature, etc. So I'm making a meal of it because this can get confusing. So what we often do, and I'm sure David did it in the introductory GR course, is that we write TMU for the vector. Okay, so we're writing that and we're saying TMU is a vector. So for example, we might write grad mu TMU is the partial derivative of T plus the connection components. So that's what we might write. So let's think about what I've just written there, okay, from a geometric perspective. So that's what we tend to write, and I'm going to be doing this mostly next week. However, strictly speaking, T mu are components of the geometric object T, and therefore scalars. So if we think about what we really mean, if we were taking grad, now I know I haven't introduced grad yet, but I know you know what it is. So the vector is really T, this geometric thing. And so grad T is really grad of T mu d by dx mu, or grad of TA EA for a general basis. So if I'm taking a derivation, that would be grad of TA times EA plus TA grad of EA. So this is in fact the partial derivative. This is what's giving me the partial derivatives. And this is what's going to give me the connection, or the gammas. So those two ways of looking at the derivative, covariant derivative, are different. And we get so used to writing this that when I start writing grad of TA is just the partial derivative of TA, it's going to sort of look a bit funny. It's going to feel like you're tripping when you first see it. I mean, tripping up, right? So I'm just warning you, you know, that will look strange until you get used to it. So Penrose calls this physicist's habit. Abstract index notation, and it's really just his way of reconciling the two communities and saying, it's okay, we do that, but this is what we mean. It's a sort of abstract thing. So just be careful about that. So just to sort of get on the home stretch here. If we think about what happens under a change of coordinates, we've assumed our coordinates on an overlap, our charts are infinitely differentiable, so I can write this, which is, of course, an operator. And so are these. And so this is simply my coordinate transformation matrix. Now, T is a geometric object. When I defined it, I made no reference to underlying coordinates other than just sort of giving a rather general hand-waving comment that, you know, the curve was C infinity in the charts and you could differentiate F in the local charts if you wanted to. But here, what happens if I change coordinates? So T doesn't care whether you use the X's or the X primes. So my T, if you remember, was T mu d by dx mu, which is T mu dx primed by dx. And so I find that I can write my components of T in the new basis by using the sort of inverse transformation. And so we find this is our contravariant transformation. And similarly, for our covectors, we get our covariant transformation. And so very quickly, we see what the problem is if we want to sort of proceed beyond just having vectors and covectors, or indeed tensors, combinations of the vectors and covectors. If we want to now start extending our differential structure and differentiating vectors, if we're going to do it thinking about bases, we quickly see what the problem is. Put it over here. So if I want to say differentiate T, so if I just write out what happens, say, to a partial derivative, because so far that's the only structure we have is some local chart and a partial derivative. then I kind of see from the sort of, you know, grungy perspective of looking at the details and the components, I see a problem. If I do all of my coordinate transformations on the components of T in a basis, then I see that d by dx mu is not actually an operator when it acts on the vector, because it depends on the choice of coordinates. That's kind of obvious, because d by dx mu is explicitly something with a coordinate in it. So if we want to define a geometric derivative of a vector, we're going to have to be more careful. So there'll be, we're going to look in turn, and I'm finishing as early as the previous lecture finished late, I think. So we're going to look in turn at three possible geometric ways of defining derivatives of vectors. So they are motivated, if, or can be motivated, by kind of looking at this extra piece that we don't want. If we look at this second derivative, which is the problem piece, it's a second derivative with respect to two copies of the prime coordinates, mu nu. So partial differentiation commutes, so that's symmetric. So one way we could solve the problem is by looking at anti-symmetric derivatives. So we'll do that, and that leads us to differential forms. And then another way of getting round it is, of course, the way that you're very familiar with, which is to step back and think, what do you mean by differentiation? You need some geometric thing. Now, if you're differentiating, you're usually comparing things nearby, taking a limit as the two things, you know, the two places that you're comparing coincide. Now, here, that's saying that you're taking a derivative at P means you've got to move away from P, which means you're going to a different tangent space. So how can you compare vectors from two different vector spaces? You have to have a way of connecting those vector spaces together. So that's what the connection is and why it's called a connection. It's a way of connecting the vector spaces together. So it's a sort of section of this tangent bundle. And then the third way of taking a derivative, which is what we'll do tomorrow, is by looking a different way of relating nearby points, and that is saying that we can connect nearby points along lines. So we take a vector field that provides a way of connecting nearby points, and we use that vector field to take a derivative. So we kind of use we use a second vector field to create a differential operator out of those partial derivatives, if you like. So then we have to look at how we transport our vectors from along to different tangent spaces, but in a very specific way along a curve. And that's the Lie derivative. So I'll stop here, more or less, not that early. And are there any questions? Hopefully that's been fairly familiar and gentle. Yes.
So why do you have new prime? Like, why do you have a prime on the new?
It's really because I don't trust myself to keep tabs on everything. So for me, it's like, you know, in case of a senior moment, I'm just making sure I remember the primed indices that are associated with the prime chart. And it's really just for accounting purposes, yeah.
And are you doing squiggly lines under covectors, or just part of this?
Squiggly or straight lines under vectors are meant to be equivalent. I think it just depends on what I've drawn previously. So the omega v in the bras and kets, there's a lot of straight lines there. So please don't, no significance to the curly line under the omega at all, whatsoever. So, sorry if it gave that impression. Okay.